Hi, Paul.
Hello.
How are you?
Boston.
Bro, Paul.
Cult hero, icon, St Andrews. How are you today?
Average. A bit like my career. I'm okay. I'm okay. Now I've been given a latte coffee this morning, which is very nice.
Where's it from?
I know. Where's it from, everyone?
There are other retailers available for your coffee, caffeine needs. Obviously very famous day now. You had a career spanning...
Is that famous or infamous?
Is it?
Okay.
It's a fine line, isn't it?
Yeah, okay.
So you played 300 games across 16 years in your career in total. So if you take us back to the start, young lad off Castle Vale.
Yeah.
16 years old, starting coming on against Leeds United.
Yep.
How was that? How did that come about? What do you remember of it?
Well, started training here when I was 11. Which I think is a good age. You know, I know the academies these days at six and fives.
Do you think that's too early?
Crackers. Mm-hmm. Mental. Yeah, you don't need. Why do you need to train at a football club 4 days a week at age six and seven? And it's bizarre. Mm. But that's the way football is, unfortunately. 11, I started training. I was playing for 3 seasons off Chelmsley Wood. We had a fantastic team. Got scouted by Villa, Blues, Arsenal, Man City. Went to Villa, went to Blues in a week. I was never going to go to Arsenal, Man City. It was too far away. But I preferred it at the Blues. Blues was very much my scene, Blues fan. I preferred the training, the family, the lads who all were training as well. I knew them as well. It was very small, much smaller than the Villa.
Around the areas.
Yeah, around the areas. Villa was, you know, from everywhere. They were a lot bigger, bigger setup. And I just preferred... You know, the training here, you know, and the lads I was training with, it was my club.
Mm.
So it just escalated from there. It went from, I signed my schoolboy forms at 12. You weren't supposed to sign till you were 14, right? So I signed when I was 12, illegally. So that was put in the drawer. Yeah, and then I had the guarantee of an apprenticeship as well with that. So that, as you can imagine, my school life, went to pot because I didn't really give a toss at school.
Then
I'm going to be a footballer. I've got a job when I've left school. So when you go and see the careers advisor, what are you going to be then, Paul? What do you want to be? I'm going to be a footballer. And this will laugh at you, and you know you better change tack there and get and think again because you're not. But it was always in my head that I was going to be. You know, I was very driven, and so that was it. I started playing. We used to train 1 day a week back then. We used to train at the opposite Birmingham Central Mosque, at Highgate. There's an AstroTurf pitch there.
Yeah.
And we used to train every Thursday there. And it was good. It was very tough, but it was good. You know, played with a lot of players like the Ian Clarksons, Matthew Fox, who went to play for the club. Lee Sharp, you know, ex-Man United in Leeds, England. He was with us as well. You know, that's another story why he didn't get taken on. But it was...
It's when the academy was good then, right? Because it was quite prestigious back then, and then it got rid of, and then we lost it.
Well, the thing is, you knew back then that you had a chance, because we had no money as a club, you had a chance of making a first-team debut pretty quickly because we had no money. And that, for me, it came to fruition. I had 16, left school 15, and within 10 months, I was within the first-team setup. You know, I was a little kid from Stechford then, you know, always in trouble on the streets, causing trouble, messing around, to, you know, being thrust into first team action. Which was crazy. I was doing really well in the youth team in reserve. So I was a forward back then. I was banging in the goals, left, right and centre. You know, I was very cute with my back to goal. I was a fantastic player with my back to goal. A bit like the Teddy Sheringham mould in that little hole.
Yeah.
And that was my position. It was always been my position until the club decided to put me in midfield because no one could run, and they put me in midfield, and I was the best runner at the club. So I made my debut against Leeds on a Friday night here under the lights, and they had a really good team, Leeds, and I wasn't ready for it, physically or mentally. I was a little kid, you know, I weighed nothing, but what do you do? Can't say to the manager, you know what, I'm really not I'm ready for this. Gary Pendry. And he was, Gary's a lovely guy, you know. He had no money to spend, really. And it was very difficult times, not like it is today. You know, the new, our younger fans see all the, you know, the fireworks and the smoke and the, you know, the big name players coming here and the wages. It wasn't like that back then. It was tough. Really, really tough. You had to fight for everything, you know, and we did.
Is that the old Division 3 as well? Or was that Division
2
then?
No, Division 2, I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was tough. There were tough times, you know, but it was great grounding. You know, we had, it was, we're back to the academy systems now and the players coming through, they don't do any jobs, or, you know, cleaning the boots, sweep the terraces. We used to do all that, do the kit, sweep the dressing rooms, clean the toilets. And it was a fantastic grounding. It made you realise what it was to be a professional footballer, where you needed to get what you need to get through. Who had gone before you?
Mm.
They've all done it.
Yeah.
Had gone before you to earn the right to be a footballer. You know, not just go out there and train well, but earn the right and understand the club and respect the club, respect the people that work for the club. You know, Tess, who worked in the kit room and done all the laundry, respect her. Get to know people within the club and understand Birmingham City for what it was.
Mm. And who was in the dressing room then that you were kind of like, that's who I want to aspire to be, or some of the
back
characters
then, back
there?
Back then, you had Rob Hopkins, Julian Dix, players like when I was coming through. I mean, when I was 12 and the club won him before I signed, and they were desperate for me to sign because Villa were all over me and, as I say, a few other clubs. I used to come in and go on away trips with the team, with the first team, staying overnight hotels with them. Those were Howard Gale, Mark McArford, and players, you know, of that ilk, Pat van der Nau, you know, when we were in the top division. So I used to go away with it and do the kit. So the club used to, like, you know, to sign for us, this is what, you know, this is what it's going to be like. And, you know, no other player got that, I think, back then.
Mm.
You know, and I used to go away on all the trips with the first team, on the coach, overnight trips, lay all the kit out, do their boots for them. And it was amazing being around those type of players, because we had our own crazy gang. You know, you had your Wimbledon crazy gang, you know, well-documented fruitcakes, but we had our own. And for me to be around them, I was, you know, mentally unstable, should we say, back then as well. And I wanted to, you know, emulate them. Wow, this is great. You know, our fan base is crazy. The team are crazy. I fit in here.
Yeah, feel right on.
You know, I feel right at home, you know, and it was great. But, yeah, so that's what it was. That, for me, I just wanted to be part of that. It wasn't about going to the Villa and, you know, and everything that they've got, the fantastic training ground. You know, Villa Park was very nice. You know, everything was beautiful down there, but when you come here and you walk out here, and it was rough. And that's my background on Castle Vale.
Spit and sawdust.
Yeah, I grew up on a 10th floor of a high-rise block of flats, and you had to fight for everything back then in those days, you know. It was rough. And this being at Birmingham City Football Club, that's what I felt at home, playing for the club.
So it's a wild contrast, isn't it? Because nowadays, to get the young kids to sign, you've got clubs buying houses for the parents. Yeah, that's the
incentive. It's crazy. The game... the game's changed. The people working within the game, the agents, it's nuts. And the amount of money and what the parents can get out of it. You know, if you've got parents there who struggle financially, and then you've got football clubs coming along and offering X, Y, Z, turning the kids' heads. It's not so much turning the kids' heads, it's turning the parents' heads. You know, and the parents will probably lean on their child to sign for a particular club because they're getting more money out of it, which is probably not right, which isn't right. But this is, you know, you can't, there's no denying the fact that that's they are facts.
And you're going back to that 5-6-year-old now, clubs try and monopolise, don't they? And just like, okay, let's have a look. And there's a whole rumour that if they see a good player, they'll sign him and his two mates who aren't as good, but it'll just get them into fold and then get rid of them lads. And
yeah, they'll do anything to get a player. It's dog eat dog. And, you know, there's that much money involved in academy football.
Yeah,
you're homegrown now for your PSR, and that's massive.
It's hard, you know. You need to get those players through the door. You know, you're competing. We're competing with Villa, with the Wolves, Albion, Coventry, all this little area, Derby, Leicester. You know, you're competing with
convoluted
clubs.
Area, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, and Villa is well documented. I think they're following the Chelsea model at the moment. You know, a Man City model. I'm getting that many through the door, loaning them out. You know, when they sign pros, you probably never hear of them. Then they're going to play for Villa, but they'll get money for them, and it was back into the club. For PSR and that, you know, and that's what they're doing, you know. And I think we're playing catch up, you know. And it's going to take a hell of a long time for us to catch them up.
Yeah,
you know, they're miles ahead of us in that department.
Yeah.
So let's go to 1995. You probably don't talk about this.
No,
the auto windscreen final.
Yes.
First ever silver goal, wasn't it?
Golden goal
at Wembley.
Golden goal at Wembley.
I scored the winner here in the quarter final against Swansea here as well. So that cup, that competition was, well, that season as well. I scored some important goals. You know, I scored the goal here against Swansea in the quarter finals. The winner, obviously, in the final at Wembley, and the goal to get us promoted 2 weeks later at Huddersfield, yeah, from 1 yard. But they all count.
Don't draw pictures on the scorecard.
Sorry?
You don't draw pictures on the scorecard, do you? You just see the...
You know, so it's...
But you were unreal that season, I remember. You were flying again.
I don't know about flying. I think what it was with the manager, with Baz, I found someone equally as mad as me. You know, and Baz, I don't think anyone's got a bad word to say, but you will find players who couldn't take him, like the proper pros at the club who, like, everything was straight down the line. I get it. You know, but for me, a lot of the other players at the club, it was just...
It feels like you just let you off your leash and just thought...
Yeah, it was just... It was crackers. It was a joy to come into training. You know, I know people might be listening to this and going, well, you should be getting paid to play football. I'd love to play football, but it's not about playing football every day. It's not about that.
Yeah.
It's not about playing five-a-side. You don't do that every day. It's a job at the end of the day, and your knees are aching, you know, having injections to train and to get through sessions, and it's horrible at certain stages, and especially when I didn't earn a lot of money out of the game. I was never on big money, you know. But when Baz come into the club, it just gave us all, you know, that impetus to go do that little bit more because of who he was. And even if he didn't have you in the team, he would treat you accordingly. He would treat you as though you were. You know, he was always...
So he kept all 147...
Well, you were meeting new people every day, weren't you?
Baz was just... It was
that not, was just a squad.
Baz was never turned down a player. He was mad.
So what was it? Was it 30 players in a month or something at the turnaround?
Just mad. I mean, it's well documented. I've said it before. We were training... We never had a training ground. So we were here, there and everywhere, which was mad enough. You know, the West Midlands travel, Sedgemoor and Yardley and Sheldon... We would go everywhere just to train, you know. And for me, if you're a proper pro and, like, you know, you go, well, we need a training ground. Yeah. But to me, I'm from the streets, really. I'm like, shit. I was like, we'll go anywhere. We'll just do what we want to do. This is great. This is great. But Baz was just crazy bringing players into the football club. I mean, we had a guy. We're training at West Midlands Travel, and we're all on. We had 49 pros. Imagine that. It was just mad. We're two reserve teams. It was just crackers. And to get into the first team, you know how hard it was to get in the first team? It was mad. So Baz was just there was this little guy standing there, and he had a ponytail, and he had a white T-shirt on, black shorts, a pair of mad football boots I've never seen before, and, like, you know, suit socks, if you're wearing a suit, black pair of suit socks. I'm looking at him thinking, she's a geezer. So I walked up to him and just been nice. I was like, oh, pal, how are you? And, you know, who are you and that? What club are you from? And are you on loan or trial or anything? No, I don't play for a club. What are you doing here then? Oh, you know, he said, well, what it was, you know, you played so-and-so on Saturday, forget the team. And I said, yeah. He said, I was your chef. What do you mean? He said, well, I was your chef cooking your food at the hotel. All right, what are you doing here? He said, well, I told Baz I could play a bit, and he's given me a trial. This geezer was about 5'2", like about 3 stone. And, like, this Baz, this is what he did. You know what I mean? He just that gem. Same thing with Jose Dominguez. Little Jose. You know, when he made his, when he had his trial at Smithswood School in Smithswood. At Castlewood, yeah. We all got in our cars here, and we said, right, we've got a practice game. What? Where are we going? Smithswood. I said, Smithswood. I was a drink over the Chelmsley and Smithswood, Toby Jug and all over there. I said, well, get over there. Is it mental? And he said, all the lads were going, what's it like? I said, it's crackers. What are we going over there for, Baz? Well, it's the only pitch we could find. The playing fields at Smithswood. And it was all the kids are there at school watching.
It's not that one on the side of the road, is it?
I can't remember how it was. Yeah.
There's one on the side of the road, then, the main road.
Yeah, it was crazy. And so we got on there, Jose Dominguez, and this little guy turned up. I think Barry Siltman brought him, I think, the old agent. And I remember Baz standing on the side, and he got out his car, he come on the pitch. But Jose's only little, he's 5'5", something like that, bow legs. we're all looking like her going, who's this? And this was it. This was the practice guy was for him. He was our first team squad.
Not speak a word of English, are they?
I can't remember. He sunk a garlic. Because Jose used to like, I don't know if you see for cloves of garlic for like for breakfast or something, but he came on the pitch and he was unbelievable. I remember Roger Willis, the right back, used to play centre midfield for us. He could play anywhere, Roger, a bit of a utility player. He just tore him inside out. His Jose was just frightening. And and that was it. Bad signed him. I think it's documented that they wouldn't pay for him, they wouldn't give him any money. But I think, you know, when you saw him play, he was just incredible.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't get the ball off him. His low sense of gravity, and he was. But that's where his trial was at Smith's Wood. Mad. You know, imagine doing that these days, telling all our players these days, right, lads, right then, Pike, we're up over Chelmsley. What for? Just have a little kick around.
Blue
I mean, I, on the blue belt field, just like, you know, all the divots and everything, glass and dog shit everywhere. Yeah, just. Well, I'm going over there for an hour. The players wouldn't do it today. They just wouldn't do it.
Talking of defecation, tell us about the T-shirt then.
From the horse's mouth. Because we've heard this before. Baz a few times. We've obviously spoke to players in and around, but we've never heard it from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken...
It was the last T-shirt in the bag.
Yeah. I mean, every time I say this, and people, it was just a weird, weird thing. I mean, Tom Ross always says, I'm telling lies and it's absolute nonsense. It was all pre-planned and nothing was pre-planned. Me pre-planned, I couldn't pre-plan anything back in those days. You know, I was a sandwich up a picnic. The first thing, we got into the dressing room. I won't tell you what happened before that on the way down because kids might be listening. It was, back in those days, you wore T-shirts under your tops, stop nipple rash, you know, but you didn't wear lycra and all that, what they get these days.
All these sports bras as well.
Sports bra and all, they get all the nice clobber, don't they? Back then it was just a free-for-all, get your pants, get your socks, get your shorts, you know, you could be wearing extra large shorts, you know, and me, I weighed like 10 stone or whatever it was, and I'd be wrapped around me three times, it was just, give me the kit, fighting to get kit, and lo and behold, there was one T-shirt left at the bottom of the kit bag, and I said to Richard, the kit man, got it out, and it was the top, honestly, it was small, really small, that's why no one had it. It was small, and me being a skinny little runt then, I said, what's this? He said, what is it? I showed him, went, I won't put that in there, the kit man. So I said, well, and it had been worn, it weren't new. So someone had, how the hell it got in there, I don't know. He said, Tate, he said, I don't know where that is. I said, I don't know how it's got in there, it's not mine, I won't put that in. I went, well, I'll wear it. I said, it's nice, isn't it? I said, I'll put that on. And I had this feeling I was going to score. You know, I scored in the quarterfinals. And I thought, you know, I was scoring a few goals back then. And I was like, and lo and behold, it happened, didn't it? And I scored, put it on. Scored. Yeah. And then, yeah, honestly, and that's when all the problems arose. For the rest of my life. You know, when you run off, you jump over the hoardings, you celebrate with all the fans, rip it off and stand there with all the fans. You know, I know that many people, you know, as you know, I'm a massive Birmingham fan and I mix with the fans. And it's not till you turn around and then, you know, Wembley, there's just under 77,000 fans there and all the cameras are there, then, aren't they? You know, the photographers. So after about 15 or 20 seconds, something like, you realise, I'm in trouble now. You bear in mind, I was always in trouble back in those days with the club. Or was it, this is your final warning. And I was, Baz got hold of me straight away. What have you effing done now? Oh my God, cover that up. Oh my God, what have you done? What's on it? Oh my God, cover it up. Oh, you're in trouble now. And I was thinking, oh my God. So it should have been the best moment of my career.
You were flying.
I was thinking, oh God, you know, what's this ain't good. This isn't good.
It was bad, wasn't it, after?
Oh, nuts. I mean, as soon as I left the dressing room, maybe the guy from the Daily Mirror, David Harris or something, wouldn't leave me alone. All over me. It was not long after Eric Cantona had done that karate kick on the Crystal Palace fan. So footballers weren't, you know, the top of everyone's wish list, really, they wanted to clamp down on them. And me doing that is another, you know, wrong thing. Yeah, so
albeit a little bit different.
Albeit
a little bit different to what Cancelar done.
Yeah, but it was going to upset a lot of people. Mm. I didn't think about that at the start, obviously.
Is the bit that followed after Shrug?
What's that?
Barry had said at his evening before about the meeting later on after. He thought you were going to get the tin tack.
Yeah, I was summoned. We went back to the Swallow Hotel in Waltham Abbey after for a get-together with the owners and Sullivan, the Golds and Karen. And I was summoned to a little meeting with the owners. Yeah, and I just thought, because I'd been sent back from Millwall in disgrace on loan that season as well. So they let me loose in London, you see. And it wasn't a good thing letting me loose in London a few months earlier. And, you know, they've said, this is your last warning. You know, I was out of control, really. You know, I was out of control. And there's me thinking, I'm going to get the sack. I've scored the win. This is it now. And I went into the room and I said, listen, I'm sorry. Shut up. They said, I went, God, you know what I mean? And they said, the T-shirt. I went, yeah. And I said, I'm sorry. And all that. Just be quiet. And where'd you get it from? And I said, it was just there. It's the story I've told. It was. I'm not lying about that. And I said, why are you asking? And they said, I'm thinking of selling them in the club shop. So we'll make an absolute fuss. And there's me thinking I'm going to get the sack. And they're thinking, poke. And I'm like, this is just mental. They're just as mad as me. Do you know what I mean? It's just mad. They're thinking about selling in the club shop.
Finally able to relax and kind of enjoy it.
And I was like, yeah. And I was like, that took the pressure off because all I could think of was, that's it, I'm done. Because I knew quite quickly that I was in severe trouble. The press wouldn't leave me alone. Then all the death threats started coming in.
Yeah.
Villa fans. Then I had to...
Because they knew where you lived as well, didn't they? I think you remember. Did you say it?
Yeah, I used to mix with a lot of their mob back in the day. And, so they were sending messages. They were fuming with me. They're a lot of their Villa youth lads and that. And I realised that, I've got to be really careful now. You know, there's nothing I could do to apologise to a lot of the Villa lads who I knew. One half of the city were wetting themselves and loving it, and the other half wanted to kill me. So I was thinking, oh, God,
It's a T-shirt.
Yeah, but you get it. If Jack Grealish would do it or Leandro would have done it, you could see our fans would have exactly the same. So listen, you do things in life which you got to take on the chin. Do you know what I mean? I upset a lot of people, and the fallout from it.
Can you imagine if that happened now in the internet era?
Yeah. Social media? It'd be mental. But I did it. You know, there's no getting away from it. But it was, I had crazy people contacting me. You know, I had proper loons sending me £5 towards my fine. I didn't know them, like Barnsley fans and things like that. And and this one said, can you come up to my house in Barnsley with your T-shirt? I said, I've made this big paper mache thing. I've got all the lighting. I said, I want you to run full pelt through the paper mache and with your arms out like that. And said, and I'll pay you. But he sent me £5, like towards me fine, just proper loons. And I think, what have I done? Have I opened up this can of worms here? Every nutter was just contacting me. All the Villa fans were contacting me. I want an apology. You're a disgrace and all this. And so I sent them an apology, but I put a tea bag in every card I sent back, or letter, to have a drink on me. So that didn't go down well. The club didn't know that. They said, I've got to apologise to all the fans and everything. But I put a tea bag in, little tea bag in there with them just to wind them up. And that didn't go down well. But
did you go to Barnsley?
No. But I obviously had to watch myself. You know, it was, you get a lot of people want to do things when you're out. And I was always on the town as well. There's no getting away from that fact. I like to go out. And, I had to really watch myself.
You had some good lads around you, though, didn't you, as well?
Oh, of course. The people I mixed with, it's well documented that I used to get involved in certain things on the terraces and outside grounds and that.
Zulus-ish. Can we talk about that or not?
If you want,
It's quite well documented that you did hang around with some heads, didn't you, at the time? So
yeah.
You used to love going to the football and being a fan, and we touched upon it before we started rolling, that it's not the same anymore, that the culture's been taken away a little bit. It's a little bit NFL and stuff, where it was go down, have a few beers, and have a punch-up.
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, it was very much, you know, coming from where I grew up, you know, when I left the Vale, when I ended up in Stechford, and I used to, you know, it was a big Birmingham area, you know, from the Broadway down to Lee Village, Soul Cross, to Marston Green, and Lee all around there. You know, I got to know a lot of lads, blues lads, and used to go to the games, and, you know, I got to know, you know, for me, people who like getting involved in situations at football games. And then because of my background, it was made for me, you know. So when I was playing, it meant so much to me, probably more than anyone else. Don't know how much it meant to the fans, you know. It wasn't just about...
It felt like you understood what we wanted to see as a fan.
Yeah, that's why I was at the start when I said I fit in so well to the psyche of the club, because it was so crazy. The fans were so crazy back then, and I was, that it meant so much to me, you know, and I wanted to be with the fans. Were like, win, draw or lose, always on the booze. And no matter what, I would always be out. If I played well or we won out, if you drew, if you lost, take it on the chin, you go out there and you face the flak. You know, you can't just take it all the smooth, you know, when you're doing well. So I'd be out. Yeah, with the lads home and away, and when I went playing, I'd go away with the lads and get myself involved in situations. You know, looking back, you know, it's not the right thing to do. I know that, but when I was younger, it was reasons for it, why the club, the fans, the Zulus and that became a part of my family, really. You know, the family that the belonging that I craved, you know, and that's led on to my addictions and, you know, the lunacy that entailed with that. But, you know, I'm still in touch with everyone, but I don't go to the games anymore, you know, for that. You know, I'll go to watch the football with my daughter and that, you know.
Tell us about, so when you were injured, when you were 19.
Yeah.
So tell us about that, and did that period play into that? Did you find things kicked up from there?
Massive, huge. I had a good upbringing, but a difficult upbringing. My parents split up, and there's a lot of issues went on, and it really affected me massively. I know parents split up every day of the week, but, you know, it does affect kids. You know, to me, it affected me massively, and my mental health. I wanted that belonging. And the club, and the supporters were my belonging. I cared so much. I never wanted to leave. The club wanted me, you know, I was doing well. A lot of clubs coming for me, Liverpool, Tottenham, Newcastle, the big clubs, Norwich, when they were very good back in the day, you know, they were the top of the league, Wolves. There's loads of clubs, you know, are coming. But the club then had done a deal with Tottenham, and I didn't want to go. No, I was happy, you know. I never earned any money at the game. It wasn't about money. The club, you always say, they put a contract in front of me and I signed it. I did. I didn't even look at it. So I'm cheap. Oh, yeah. And I went to, when I come out of the game now and I realise, God, all them players are like 10 times on the same team as me. I'm 10 times more money than me.
Really?
Yeah. And to me, it wasn't about money. Like, you know, it was about, I'm at the club I love, I'm with the fans I love, and I want to play for the club. I don't give a toss about it. You know, now I've come out of the game, I wish I'd have had more of a head on me, you know.
Was you mindful as well when you went back to the whole Millwall thing, that in the smoke at Tottenham, that you might not be headspace to do it as well? Or were you just like, I don't want to go for the Blues? Or was that...
I'll go back to 19. Let's go back to when it's not in what happened. Like, obviously, the deal was done with Spurs. All I had to do was sign. Yeah, I knew how much I was going to get. And to me, it was astronomical figures for me compared to what I was on. Living in London, God knows, I'd have given myself 6 months down here. I'd have been dead. You know, knowing now what my psyche in God knows what I've got up to. I got injured. Orient, first tackle of the game, 13 seconds by John Sitton, you know, the Orient guy does all the YouTube stuff. And, you know, and back then it was tough. You know, he done me the tackle. I could have done him. He's just one of them. He hurt me. And I was finished, you know, and I was stretched off. I ruptured my posterior cruciate at the back, but I broke the tibial condyle of my knee, which is the joint. So it was shattered very much like a car crash. So I was taken to a surgeon in Birmingham, They put me on the coach on the way back. They took me to the Roding Hospital in East London. And they had a look at my leg. Well, what have you done now? And he said, who have you been playing? This specialist said. And I said, Orion said, I'll teach you to mess with us Londoners.
No.
And I'm on the bed screaming. Yeah, crackers it was. And I was like in agony. I'm in the damage. I was thinking, oh, my God. So they took me to a hospital in, I think it was it the Nuffield or the Priory in Birmingham. And the surgeon opened it up. And said, there's so much damage. This is massive. And then I was taken by my agent at the time to David Dandy in Cambridge, who was the leading specialist at the time for knee injuries. Right. Opened up, had a look, did all the scans, MRIs, and he just had me and my parents down there. And he just said, the first word he said was, can you do anything else? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, you won't play football, son. He said, you're finished. He said, you'll be lucky if you walk again properly. He said, the amount of damage you've got in that knee. He said, it's very reminiscent of a car crash. My mum just burst into tears and I'm just sat there going,
can't process it.
Oh, wow. You know, I knew it was bad. I knew it was bad. It was battered. He was smashed a bit. So he said, I'm going to perform this operation to get you to walk again. And I went, okay. So he took bone from my hip, scraped it all off, put it in my knee, remoulded my knee to some resemblance of what it used to be, pins, bolts, and see you later, off you go, and come and see me in a few months. In that meantime, Dave McCoy got the sack, Lou Bakari come in. Bearing in mind then I wasn't massively into alcohol. I'd have a drink, but I wasn't crazy. I wasn't into the drugs and everything. And this was my life, this is my club. And then I remember Lou Bakari called me and my dad in to a meeting in the physio room. Bearing in mind I never met him. Just taken over, and he said, the reason I think you got injured, Paul, was because you drink too much. But I didn't drink too much then. I said, who said that? I said, I don't even know Lou Bakari, by the way, I've never met him. I said, did you realise the club had selling me, I'd done a deal with Tottenham? You know, what was very well thought of at the time as a new kid on the bike, as a kid coming through in the country, really. And they packed me off to Lillishaw, the rehabilitation centre where all players went, for 3 months, not a phone call from anyone at the club for 3 months. Bear in mind, I'd played first team football that season. Mm. Obviously, got injured playing first team football. And I didn't hear anything. Nothing, not a word. Just packed me off. Off I went, staying from Monday to Friday on my own in a room, injured. Couldn't walk on the crutches.
No club welfare officer phoning.
There was no welfare back in those days. They had nothing. I'll come back to the club to see the physio. To just check me over, then back I went for 3 months. And been in that meantime, Lou was only here 4 months, wasn't he, or something?
Mm.
Something like that, and he'd gone. And I never heard a thing. And I leaned onto the line and that final, I think I played in the competition that season as well. And I didn't get an invite to the final. They bought me a ticket. It was nuts how I was treated.
Yeah, you said you'd scored some goals, hadn't you, on the way to the actual final as well?
It was so bizarre what had happened. And it really, that year out, I was out for 12, 13 months. And, you know, at Lillishaw, they, you know, brilliant, the guys at Lillishaw, the physios there were the top draw, they were brilliant with me. And I was, you know, a mix with a lot of ex-pros, you know, from other clubs like Ted McMinn was there and who come here. So, you know, they took you under their wing, you know, and it was nice being surrounded by. If it wasn't for them, I would have gone under probably. So that's when my addictions really started. I fell into going out all the time, into taking drugs. Alcohol was just became a massive part of my life. I thought, well, I'm never playing football again. The club don't want me. All I wanted was that belonging. And someone to put their arm around me and say, listen, everything's going to be all right, but I never had that. And I went from being a first-team player to being a mental wreck, shall I say. I think the club wanted the insurance money for me, I think, back then.
I've read that. Kumar's wanted to write me off.
They wanted to write me off, and get some whatever they could get, whatever insurance they had for me. Oh, God knows what it was. Couldn't have been a lot. But, yeah, so it was, it killed me, really. You know, and that's when, I'd say that's when my real addictions to alcohol and drugs started. I was mixing with some really heavy people back then. you know, from
was that constant arm ranger point in front of you, or
yeah,
a little bit of the other
then? It was a drinking culture back then, right?
It was a drinking culture, yeah. It was a drinking culture, I get that. And it's well documented, any club you speak, it was a drinking culture. But for me, I went from drinking, but not too much. You know, it was a great train. I'd run all day long, you know, to going from drinking a few pints to drinking loads to taking any drug going. And I'd have any drug going to get through that. The pain of my injury to being disregarded by the clubs, to being thrown on the scrap heap, to this is my family. You know, as I was alluding to the fact that my mum and dad split up, and it destroyed me, if I'm honest with you. And, you know, I won't go too much into that, but, you know, we had some bad things happen to me. So with the club turning the back on me, I fell massively into bizarre things, you know, the things I got up to, and the people I was mixing with, aviators, you know, from across the city.
Did it come to a point then when you were just like, okay, enough's enough, or was it just opportunities then
to get
fit again, and you kind of went in?
I started to get fitter, and when Lou left, Terry Cooper took over. And he was honestly, what a man.
Yeah.
Lovely. Brilliant man manager. And that's what I needed. I need someone to give me a kick up the arse or to put their arm around me as well. You know, I needed that. I needed that family thing. I needed that. Someone who understood me, because I wasn't Copus Mentis. I was very, very difficult. But because of my background, you know, because of my early childhood experiences, which were never resolved. Terry would just love, I can't so well with Terry and his wife Rose. You know, I owe him so much. And he just said, like, listen, what's going on? You know, we're going to support you. And they supported me. They worked so hard with me with injury. Bear in mind, you know, the likelihood of me coming back was probably 70-30 that I wasn't. But I was in my head, I wouldn't give in. I think why I wouldn't give in as well, because I didn't weigh much. I didn't have much weight going through my knee. Yeah. I wasn't a big lad. So it was in my head, I'm giving in. I'm never going to give in. I'm gonna come back. And I remember I got to a point where I was running. And I thought, okay, and then the final decision was we were playing, they arranged the game for me at Wast Hills, the training ground, against Bristol City. And they said, this is it. If you get through this, you've got a great chance of prolonging, of coming back at a level. If you don't, we don't know if your leg's just going to it's going to disintegrate with a tackle, because I hadn't really tackled up to them because they were too scared, because the bone had to mould and all the pins and bolts in there.
Mm. You're white, that first contact.
You can imagine, can't you? I'm going to this game, there's loads of people watching around the pitch, staff and everything, and players thinking, well, you know, probably hated me, thinking, I'm hoping that his knee's going to explode tomorrow. So, yeah, so I... Because I was a bit crazy back then, I flew into the first tackle. You know, I flew into it, and it withstood.
Mm-hmm.
But I went in with my stud showing. Yeah, I would never, you know, like a...
Yeah, you're not easy.
I went in with my stud showing. I wasn't just going to go in over a little block.
Let's test it out
properly. And I went in, and it was fine. And I could hear the gasp from everyone, because it was that hard to tackle. And I went...
Was it like or not?
I don't know, can't remember. But I scored in the game. We lost 2-1. And I got through it. I actually got through the game, and it was, the relief was, I can't tell you, but you know when you don't feel the same.
Yeah.
Your knee's not the same. I'm not the same player that I was before.
Do you feel that in pace or stamina or all?
Yeah, you lost. I was quite nippy. You know, I could see things, but then I'd lost that and I couldn't do certain things. Although I got through the games, and people said, oh, you were fantastic at this and fantastic at that. In my mind, I was not the same. I was just getting through. I was thinking, well, it's going to explode. I've had that much damage to my knee, the bone.
I imagine, right, ideally, it's like...
And the bone, I could feel the pins at the side of my knee sticking out. It was because I was like a bionic man, really. It was just like battered. But how I got through, I don't know, to this day. And even the surgeon, David Dandy, when our physios used to take players down there, he used to always ask about me. Can I ask about that player you brought, Mr. Tate, and all that? He's how is he? Is he? And he couldn't believe, he was one of the leading surgeons at the time back in the day, that I'd got through it. He said, I cannot believe that lad is still playing football. He even got to anywhere near it. because of all the damage. But I don't know, I got through it. I don't know if it was luck, but it was my desire. You know, I'm a fighter, and I'm not going to give in. You know, I'm going to get through this. And I got through it, you know, and I was so lucky, but I was never the same.
Mm.
You know, I carried on playing in the first team, but there was always a back of mind, you're not the same. You know, you're not the same. You can't do certain things, Paul. You know, you can't do certain things, but I got through it. And I got more contracts, and I played for another, 13 years after, which I was so lucky. So lucky, you know, like I'll thank everyone for the people who gave me the support. This, you know, the surgeon at the time, what a job he did for me, you know, and the people around me at the club, and all, you know, your likes of Neil McDiamond and people like that who were fantastic with me when he came into the club, got me, Baz, Terry Cooper, yeah, but there's certain people at the club back then, like Lou McCary and that, who just wrote me off, and off you go, and to pack someone who wasn't mentally stable. For 3 months on their own in a room. Oh, God, it was tough. It was tough, really tough. And then watching the club go to Wembley and things like that, and not getting invited, bearing in mind as part of the squad, buying your own tickets for the game. I went down with all the lads from the Glebe in Stechford, and I was at Trafalgar Square in the fountain and all that. It was crazy times, you know. But and watching the lads win as well, I was so glad we won. God just wanted us to win, but not being part of it, not being around it.
And it's again, horrible. If you're fragile as well, then that's,
yeah,
that's was, horrible, isn't it?
Yeah, I was, you know.
You look at the contrast with that. When we played Arsenal, he had Cesc Fabregas arranged to go up and get the trophy, didn't they, before the actual final?
Yeah.
It's a different time, though, isn't it? It's a different time. Yeah.
Yeah, it's different times and different times. And
Different managers,
people. It was just totally different back then. And I've got a lot of animosity towards what certain people at the club did to me. So it's not the club. You know, it's not like Birmingham City, it's the people working within your club. You know, so if you've got to differentiate, and that's why I find it hard to differentiate. You know, I've got a lot when Grange speaks about the club.
You've got to
say, hold on a minute, it's not Birmingham City, the club, it's not the fans, it's not the club, it's people working for the club. So it's different. You've got grubs with certain people, and that's what it is.
Yeah. And it's easy to look at it as support and think, why are they not coming down? And Grange come down at the weekend and stuff, and you've got a good ovation for it. And I think due to some of the clips that have been out recently, some of ours and stuff as well, people are realising, what? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The heartache that it brings, that you're like, well, I don't want to come down the Blues anymore because it just brings back all those feelings.
Yeah, and it's like that, you know, Grange is right, and there'll be other players like that as well, you know, which fans don't know about. Fans all fancy is you're on the pitch, you're training, and you're earning X amount of money, and you should be doing this, and you should be doing that. But at the end of the day, we're all human. And, you know, a lot of us are from working class backgrounds, from council house estates. And we're just, I always say, there's no difference to me or you. I'm a Birmingham fan like you are, and I just play football. I was just probably better at football than you, allegedly. So that's all it is. You know, there's no airs or graces.
And like that's the old adage at the moment, isn't it, that people are like, well, he's on 40, 50 grand a week, 100 grand a week or whatever.
Yeah.
And Mbappe is a thing at the moment, isn't it, that he's saying it's
tough. I was asking the other day, weren't it? Chelsea were asking De Sassi and Sterling, they're nowhere near the squad. How do you feel for them? So, well, my dad's a fisherman, he's 75 years old, he works 12 hours a day. That's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's a completely different thing.
Yeah, but he got castigated for that, didn't he? That you can't really still say that, can you?
But he did, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Because he's old school, isn't he? But it's frowned upon now to be like, well, they are young men who are being similar situation, isn't it? To what happened to you.
They've been cast out of the team and no one's talking to him. It's not, doesn't matter how much money
you've got. You've got a bit of PFA and stuff this
no, you,
round, yeah, you, you, what you was doing and stuff. And
yeah. Yeah,
people who can go and speak to.
Yeah, yeah. No, you have. Yeah, back in the day, you had no one. You know, you just had to get on with it.
So just again, not to hinge too much on the negativity and those things, but we were talking before, weren't we, about the testimonial?
Yeah.
And obviously, with Grindr being down here, and we were talking about his last week, and then you were sharing about your proposed testimonial. What happened with that?
Crazy. I mean, as I said before, the contract talks and everything, they said, well, we'll offer you this, and you got we'd like to offer you a testimonial. Been here since you were 12, and that's all I ever wanted. I said, oh my God, wow, he's just, I'm so, so happy. I'll sign anything. And I signed. And then when you go through the process of trying to get game, like Grange, you run into obstacles, big time. Well, I mean, the date they give me was, I think it was 1998, 2 days after the World Cup final. Was it in France, 1998?
Yeah, can't remember. Like that, yeah.
And I said, well, can I get a team then? I said, all the teams all the top players are away for a fortnight after. I'm going to get a team, all players to come, clubs are going to come here. Well, that's the date you got. Oh, Jesus Christ, I'm not going to get a game. And then they said, you've got to give us X, you know, you've got to pay for the toilet rolls, you've got to pay for the stewards, you've got to pay for this, you've got to pay for that. And but they don't tell you this when you sign the contract. You're very, very naive. I was. And you suddenny realise that, actually, this ain't going to happen. This game, for it to get on, it's just not going to happen.
What did you say about the flyers and stuff as well?
Yeah, so I had, you're thinking, I had a golf day. The club wouldn't advertise anything for me. Like, I had a dinner in a Bermondsey Centre in the Burlington Hotel. Lovely hotel. It was called The Three Amigos with Barry Fry, Ron Atkinson and John Sillett. And I had a comedian, Terry Alderton, who was on EastEnders. It was great. It was going to be a great night, 300, 350 people and all that. So I said to the club, can I put some in the programme? Can I do anything in the boxes or, you know, put my flyers out? No. No, you can't do anything. I'm not doing anything for you. What? I said, what do you mean? I said, why not? And I said, I wouldn't say no, I wouldn't say anything. So what I did during the game, I'll go around all the boxes and introduce myself and said, listen, this is my fly for my testimonial dinner. Would you be interested and all that?
Introduce yourself.
People are like... But I did though. I went around
every single
box.
In the people like, you don't need to introduce
every single box I went round.
Yeah.
And gathered out my flyers, introduced myself. It'd be great if you could make it to support my dinner. Blah, blah, blah. Everything's got to be paid for. Baz wants his poke, and they all, you know, I mean, Baz will do nothing for nothing. You know what I mean? You don't even know he's my manager. Take, give me that, sort that cash. You know what I mean? All right, Baz. So I've always got a swimming pool in his house, and I ain't. And yeah, so it was just mad. I couldn't get anything. And Trevor was the manager then. And I was like, oh my God, this is murder. Murder. But we had a great night. It was sold out at the Burlington Hotel, and it was a brilliant night. It was brilliantly supported. I was so made up. Any money I made from it, my agent had, and ended up in a drug den in Handsworth with it. So, you know, unbeknown to me, he was part. He knew load of the. I won't mention the name.
Yeah.
There's two big gangs in Birmingham. He was with one of them, and all my dough was over there. So I had to go and threaten him, and to get me dough, and.
Yeah. Not ended in a Handsworth drug den trying to get your money back.
Well, I didn't go over there. I would have been shot, wouldn't I? So it was just mad. And, so it could only happen to me, couldn't it? You know, whatever money I'd made from it, it would suddenly disappeared. And he was over with very, very dangerous people. And I was thinking, well, I've got to get it back somehow. I ain't letting it go. I've got to stand on and have it. And I got it back in the end. We found out where he lived and that now. Yeah, got it back.
So touching upon it, so who's your favourite manager? So out of, I know Terry Cooper and Barry Fry.
It's different, different people.
I know Trev wasn't up there.
Trev knew the game, and I suppose you want to speak about Trev in a bit, but Trev is not my cup of tea. Yeah. But Terry Cooper is such a nice man, knew football, knew the game inside out.
Well, he was a class player.
Really, a man manager, lovely, lovely guy. Got the team playing well. Baz was great because he was just, you could not like Baz really. You know, I got on with Baz so well that we just clicked. He'd slaughter me in games, you skinny beasts. He'd absolutely rinse me. And then I'd just say the same to him, you fat little. And that's the relationship we had, like a father-son relationship. It was crazy, but we got on so well. You know, and I loved playing for him. I can't remember any tactics we ever had or anything. You know, when you speak to former players.
Was there any tactical names?
Score more than the other team, I think it was. I think with Baz, I can't ever remember us sitting down and going through how the opposition, the strengths of opposition, or they may have said, oh, he's good at on the ball, you've got to be careful there. It was just go out and run your knackers off, be aggressive, and go and score some goals. And I think the teams that we had then when he was here, we did that. The players that we had playing, it was buzzing down here, wasn't it? It was the atmosphere.
Yeah.
A home and away, full of loons. Mm. It was just
Brilliant.
Crazy, crazy times. Mm. And bad, the rapport that we had, the players and the fans then, was just brilliant. There's something that will never be repeated.
Yeah.
You know, you won't get your fans here now, your players now going into the Roost or the George after the game, having the top lot we use because they can't, social media, get all that.
Yeah.
But we did, you know, the Moseley Arms, the Adam and Eve, all the Barcelona, everywhere, we'd be out with the fans after the games.
Who were the characters that you had? So you played with Mark Ward and stuff.
Yeah, Ward was a good friend of mine. I ruined his marriage. Yeah, he got divorced because of me.
Expand on that.
No, I used to take him dinner to my
place. We've seen him at Very One of Riders.
He's just crazy class, but I seen him the other day at Euston Station. We stood next to each other and we didn't know it. And we were looking up at the board at our trains. I just looked. The little man standing right next to me. He's a great friend of mine. I used to have to get back to Liverpool on the train, didn't I? Can you drop me back at New Street? And I used to do a little detour. Take him to some of my drinking dens with Mark knew as well. And once Mark had had a drink with me, he'd miss his train. And obviously his missus would be going off a nut. And he did that. God, for loads of Tate. She's going to divorce him. If I don't, honestly, I said, I should be all right. And then she did. She divorced him. Yeah. He had a mad relationship with her. I went up to Liverpool once and we went out for the night and we got back in about 5 or 6 in the morning and she locked us out. She locked us out. And I said, where are we going to get in? He said, don't worry. And just picked up a slab, walked up to his front window, was straight through the window, massive slab. And I was like, hands on my head, what are you doing? He said, it's all right, I do it every week. You know, just put a slab through his front window and that's how we can climb in through his window. It was all glass everywhere, he's just nuts. But Wardy was a very good friend of mine, as is Liam Daish. What a captain, what a man, what a leader. You know, you
that
don't
leads us into something else, doesn't it?
You don't mess around with that man. You know, so I spoke to him yesterday, 2 days ago. I love him. I love that man.
Has he been asked to come down and do anything down the Blues?
He was here. He was academy manager, wasn't he? Last September. Liam's a leader. What a captain. Very much like a Roy Keane type person.
Mm. Yeah. So without incriminating anyone, tell us about Ancona.
Yeah.
So obviously that season you were talking about, I read one of your interviews, said that a lot of the games were won before in the tunnel.
Yeah.
Where you do certain things, the opposition.
We used to like get into them, yeah. It was, we had a team then who liked to mix it a bit on and off the pitch. You know, we're big characters, a lot of leaders in the team. And they had little rats like me who would just do the dirty work for them, really, wind everyone up and then run behind
the grenading.
I'd run behind the bigger lads and like that and stick my fingers up at the bigger boys from the other team. But yeah, it was, we used to like try and intimidate teams in the tunnel back then. You know, you can't do it now, obviously, the cameras and everything. But then it was crazy, you know, it was crazy. And the Ancona thing, there was no love lost between the Italians and the English. Their manager was mental, Massimo Cacciatore's name. It was. I was playing. Obviously, I was in midfield, and we were playing. And a lad did a tackle, and all of him was coming late. And I grabbed him. You know, he's on the floor, and I just grabbed his shirt. Like, what are you doing? Late tackle, and it's a bit of a set to him. Before you know it, I got a whack in the back of the head. I turned around. It was their manager on the pitch. He'd run on the pitch and hit me. And I was like, oh my God, there's a little fat kid on the pitch attacking me. So then we knew then after that it was going to go. You know, the tackles were flying. We won 1-0. You know, we won 1-0, we beat them 1-0. And we knew afterwards it was, you know, potentially going to go off, you know. And it did.
You know, we won. You looked after yourselves?
You had to.
It was hostile, wasn't it?
Well, I've read that you had Barry Fry jumping all over you and you accidentally broke the referee's finger, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. It was mad. The referee, because you had English refs go travel with you, and if we played here, they had Italian refs in lines, you know, so they travelled with the team. Yeah, it was crazy. It was just like a free-for-all battle. Yeah, it was mad, and the ref was cowering on the steps. He had like big steps going up to the dressing room areas, but then it went like a massive big area. Like, so he had all the Italians one area and had all the players here, and it was just
look of glee on your face, you was in your element
back then. Yeah, because you knew you weren't going to get arrested and you were fighting, and I might come across as donut. It was like Birmingham City,
yeah.
And for me it wasn't just about, you know, you having a fall, because, you know, it was Birmingham City.
I think it seemed like they thought they could intimidate you.
Yeah, they're on home soil, and yeah, but they don't understand the players that we had within our team, our squad.
Who else was that? You, Daesh.
I think be careful playing by Barnett. It was lads who liked, could handle themselves, you know, who wouldn't shirk. Yeah, and
Willis was probably in the
Roger Willis. Season. He was a nice kid, him, you know. Was he it? Wasn't really a lad. Yeah, big, you know, we had lads who could handle themselves. Paul Harding, by Barnett was very tasty. Yeah. And they just come off second, you know, it was just one of them. You had to win. And we did. And, you know, you see the manager getting carted off then on a stretcher. All the police come with their machine guns and they pin you in your dressing room, trying to get your passports off you. But they were so racist. You know, they weren't saying it's all the black lads that wanted our black lads and David Howells, our coach. And in all due respect, they didn't do anything. They never. You know, certain individuals did more than others.
How did you all get out of any passports? Obviously, it's documented that certain players, Daesh Johnson, shouldn't go back.
Yeah, they can't go back. We were there for ages, and the police were standing outside. We were under armed guard in the dressing room area, thinking we're all going to, you know, get nicked and blah, blah, blah. And they got us on a coach straight to the airport under blue lights. Our coach got attacked by their fans outside. Yeah, it was, and then we got back to Birmingham International, and then the news were there, ITN. I'd heard about it because their manager was stretched off, and, you know, fractured cheekbone and damaged his eye socket and all this. This happens when you fall over, and
when you throw the first punch.
Well, I
when you shoot someone in the back of the head.
No comment there. And it was crazy. It was really crazy times, you know. And you knew then that the competition wasn't gonna.
Going to say that was the end of the Anglo family, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was dodgy. You know, things could have happened further down the line then, you know. But that was so racist towards our black players. Yeah, it was crazy. Crazy. You know, we want the black players. We want him and him. It was, oh, God, nuts. But like Liam and that, you know, they can't go back. Mm. The permanent warrants out for their arrest in Italy. If they ever go back, they'll probably get nicked for it. So, so don't go back.
It's the legacy of the Anglo Italian
Cup. Yeah.
Right. So, at what point do we, or do you kind of, so this, your career carries on. Obviously, your addictions are kind of building. At what point do you, where's your crossroad where you went, enough's enough, and then you move towards recovery? Was it a single moment or?
Not till nearly 10 years ago. I was an addict all through my career. All through my career. I hid it from most people. I got caught by the club. I think Ricciardo got caught with some weed in Hackney in East London, and in his car, you know, police stopped him and got caught. So obviously got charged, or maybe got charged, but I think he got caution. So then the club had us in at the Sedgemoor where we were training, and they just said, "Listen, if anyone's got issues, if anyone has taken drugs, we're going to do drug tests now."
Oh, is that what it was off the back of?
And you come clean. If you're not clean and we catch you were going to sack you and all that. And obviously everyone looked at me like, and I was like, yeah, what was
the whole room?
And I come clean and I went, yeah, listen, I've got an issue, or, you know what I mean? I've got problems. And they did tests on me. Fair play to Karen. Karen, if it wasn't for Karen, I know Karen gets a lot of bad press. But for me, she was great for me at that particular time. If it wasn't for her, I'd probably been dead then. She, obviously they tested me and I was a couple of substances that I found to have in my system. And she said, listen, we're going to help you. We're going to put you in the Woodbourne Clinic, probably in Edgbaston. It's like an addiction clinic, or, you know, for ailments and that. Okay. So every Monday morning I had to go for a drug test for about 18 months. And then on Thursdays, I had to go for therapy with a crack counsellor, Mr. Khan. I didn't like him, so I only lasted about 3 weeks with him.
Was it hard? Was it hard being counsellor at that time?
I just wouldn't want to speak to him. Any addict will tell you, if you're not ready to stop, someone can give you 10 million quid. If you're not ready, you know, you're not ready. You've got to hit rock bottom before... you seek help, real help. If you're serious about stopping, you know, there's no money in the world, there's nothing your wife, your kids can say to you. Nah. If you're an addict, you've really got to dig deep and hit rock bottom. At the light bulb moment, you're going to go, you know, jail, institutions, death, you know, which way are you going to go? You know, and for me, Karen was absolutely magnificent for me. She really was. I sorted out the clubs that were going to help you. And then, you know, every Monday I'd go into my little cubicle with the two nurses, one there, because I tried to put I had a little test tube above someone's wee. I was going to put in it because I'd been using it. Well, caught again. And then after that, I'd things like crash my car on the way there and things like that because I'd been using. And Karen said, Karen, I've had an accident and all that. All right. And because I knew that the stuff would be out of my system the week after. But I was gone. I was addicted, you know. I was addicted, and it was, you know, and I was, all my money was going on it. I wasn't on big money, don't forget. I wasn't on massive money at the club. I never was. I fell into a lot with dealers, you know, really heavy people. And, you know, I owed a lot of money to people. Am I going to pay this? Am I going to pay that? I've got no money. So people running out here on a Saturday thinking, oh my God, I've got a boat we win today to get the win bonus because I owe God so-and-so this, I owe so-and-so that. My mortgage fell behind, you know, with all the, you know, with everything that I was spending and I didn't have any money. I was, oh God. And I got through everything with more drugs and alcohol, you know. So in the end, it took over my life. And the situations I got was more dangerous. You know, the people I was mixing with became more dangerous. You know, I was getting a name on the town as the wrong one, and, you know, I was getting banned. I got a life ban off Broad Street and things like that in the end. I was getting involved in things I shouldn't have been getting involved in. And that, it just escalated. And then I was up in Scotland and it was getting, doing silly things up there. And yeah, so it all, the addictions just totally took over my life. Totally took over. And it went all through my career. And it was 10 years ago, February coming up, that I had the light bulb moment, which they say you have. And I thought I was going to die. And that was it. You had a choice. You've got a choice here. What are you going to do? And I was in tears and I was, oh, it's just horrific, horrific. And you have to make that choice of you go down path A or path B. I chose the right path, you know, at the moment. I'm on the right path and I have been for nearly 10 years. But it was horrific, horrific. And all, you know, people will look and say, oh, you know, and, you know, no one forced you into taking drugs. No one did, no. But I didn't get up that day when I was 19, I was in, and go, I've got a great idea. I'm going to be a drug addict. What an idea that is. I'm going to do every penny I've got in. I'm just going to go mental. And that's it. You know, I was escaping things that, in my early childhood experiences, that
trauma that you
had. The trauma that I had as a kid, which I buried. And that's why I'm so, I love working with youngsters now, that just because they are doing things which are irregular behaviour, you don't write them off. There's something going on for them that we need to help our youngsters, you know, we need to help them, and even adults. I mean, when I actually come and said that I was an addict and I'm struggling on my Facebook thing, I had about, there was 18, I think it was, blues fans contact me straight away. I said, listen, I'm struggling. Can you help? I can't help them, but I can signpost them and say, listen, if you want me to, I went with some former players come to me. I took them to meetings and to fellowships to try and help them, but I knew they weren't ready. It was just a thing for their missus and that, you know, to say, look, listen, I'm trying, congestion, but I knew, and you know, when you speak to people, you have to change your whole way of life. Your friends you've been knocking around with for 30 years, you've got to change. You can speak, but you've got to change your circles. You can't go in pubs. Well, you're an alcoholic or a drug, and you're going to go in a pub and mix with the same people. But what's going to happen? You're just digging a pin in yourself all the time. You've got to change. You've got to totally change your whole way of life. And it's so hard to change.
Is the support out there now
for
ex-professionals?
Yeah. Oh God, yeah, You know, you got the Sporting Chants, who are fantastic, you know, or I'm still in therapy with them. Just finished my last lot of therapy with them. They were they're fantastic.
That's Tony Adams.
Tony Adams set it up. He doesn't have much to do with them now. It's escalated from that. But he set it up because of all the problems he had when he was a player and there was nothing there. But, you know, I went through with them and they're great for players, for sports people, you know, because there's so many people struggling. And it just does, just because you play a sport and you're good at it and you're professional in the public eye doesn't mean you've got issues. All of us have got issues. It's just how we deal with them.
Well, the thing is, we've talked about this before, haven't we? And especially like the tragedy of Ricky Hatton last week as well.
Yeah.
Talk about how you go from the elation of being adored and being held upon a pedestal by 10, 20, 30,000 people.
70,000 people.
Yeah. Away. And then you don't have that.
Yeah.
I mean, we can have boredom or issues as lay persons, but once you've lived at that level, how do you get then to kind of a civvy street level where your head doesn't
fall off? It's a structure as well, you know, because when you're a footballer or a professional sports person, it's everything structured. Everything's done for you. You're like, you know, you know what time you're training. You know what time you're eating. Everything's there every single day of the week for 15 years. Like in the army, they struggle. They come out into civvy street and they're like, what do I do now?
It's prison, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really weird. You know, it's like when you come out of the professional game, for the first month, you're not going to have a drink or whatever, you know, and think, oh, God, what's all that about? You reflect. And then what do you do now? Now, what do you do now? You might have a business going, you might have a few quid in the bit, but, you know, I think there's 50% of marriages, professional sports people, footballers, they split up in the first 2 years because you go from a structure, money coming in, to no money coming in. If you haven't looked after it, you haven't got your head together, you've been struggling.
You are off feet
on 24 hours.
You're under each other's feet, and what do you do? You know, it's not easy. You know, it's just life, but it's how you deal with it. It's difficult. You know, back to me, what I did, I carried on what I was doing when I was playing. You know, I still mixed with the lads. I went to the games, you know, the lads, get involved in things, you know, and that's what I did until you know, I thought I was going to die. And
do you find then certain parts of those circles fall away when you do, all of a sudden you don't want to be out doing
this? Yeah, because I mean, for the first 3 years of me not, when I made that decision, I didn't go down the game. You have to stop. You have to change your circles. Yeah, you're on the end of the phone, your pals and that, which I still speak to, and I still see all the lads, you know, the games. But you can't do it. You've for my first 3 years, I took my dog. I went and sat on a hill, this farmer's field by where I live, all weathers, 3 o'clock, every Saturday till 5 o'clock, in all weathers, throwing the ball down the hill, dog back, and phew, phew, walk a bit, phew, throw the ball, dog, bring it back, and get me into that psyche of this is your new life. You can't go down that football anymore, because that was a red rag for me. It was like, once I'm there with the lads, I'd be out 10 o'clock on a Saturday, the home game, and I wouldn't come back till Monday or something. You know, I'd end up in the most maddest places, you know, no money and just wrecked.
Everyone likes having Paul Tate with them.
Yeah.
Oh, look, we've got Paul Tate.
Yeah, whatever drugs I'd had, much alcohol I'd consumed, and, you know, I'd be in bits. And then I'd come back Monday, my wife, my kids, they'd see me, and it's awful. What you don't realise, it's very narcissistic, very selfish, as a life as an addict. You know, you're so selfish because you don't see the picture. You don't see, all you see is you. Mm. What can I get out of this? Mm. You know, look, you don't care about anyone when you're an addict. You want to, but all you care about is where you're getting your next bit of gear from, where you're getting your next pint from, who can buy you a pint, who can get you some gear. And, you know, my nose is completely wrecked from years of abuse. You know, and I'm sure there's parts of my body inside which are hanging by a thread. But, you know, over the last 10 years, I have really tried to focus a bit more on living better and helping people really as well, you know, or signposting them. And because there's so many people out there, you know, all of us are all struggling. It's just how we deal with things. Yeah. And that's what it is. You know, it's just how we deal with certain situations.
Mm.
Yeah, it's difficult.
So nearly 10 years, which is obviously an amazing achievement. So tell us now about what you're doing and how you're helping others.
Yeah.
Let's say signposting people.
Yeah. Well, I was working for the club for 3 years. I left in January with the academy, which was great. You know, working in the 21s and the 18s, you know, got a lot of enjoyment from that. But, you know, fortunately it come to an end. But I've run Midland soccer coaching now for the last 20 years. And, you know, I do that working with youngsters, coaching them football and taking them to clubs if they want to go to clubs. Now, I'm not too keen, as I said before. You know, I think it's a bit way too early, but parents, it's the parents really pushing it, really. Yeah, and signposting people who require help, who would like help, really. It's difficult, as I said before. There's no quick fix to someone who's struggling. You have to understand why, what has happened to you. And that's all my trauma-informed training comes into it. It's, you know, when I worked in schools, a couple of high schools for a couple of years, working in the pastoral departments, working with kids who are getting thrown out of class all the time. Your teachers haven't got the time to work and focus on these kids because they're Ofsted and they've got results and they've got targets to it. So these kids who are really struggling at home, they come into school, may get shouted at by a teacher in the first 5 minutes, just been shouted at home, come from a real difficult background. The easiest thing to them to do is verbal back to the teacher, right, off to reflection for the rest of the day again. And then they'd come to me. I'd work with them and I'd really get to know them. It's not about the behaviour. It's about what's happened to them. Why are they exhibiting, all our kids exhibiting this behaviour in pastoral care, you know, and schools if they're in trouble, the same kids? We really need to work on them because all that's going to happen, they're going to get removed from the school, managed move into a proof centre, and then the likelihood is they're going to offend when they leave school.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but the likelihood is.
And it's the start of a villain story, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you're like, oh, I've been kicked out of the...
Yeah. I was that kid, I got suspended from school regularly. You know, in the end, I didn't do any of my exams because the school couldn't handle me. I did really bad things at school. But I've always been a person that has never trusted authority and teachers. I absolutely hated teachers, but I won't go into that now why I did. But it shaped me and all my behaviour, my regular behaviour, because of what happened to me at school, right? And that for the rest of my life has shaped me. Now, I told in therapy 10 years ago what had happened to me. I never told anyone what happened to me at school with a particular person. And it was a light bulb moment that, oh my God, this is all my behaviour at school with people in authority, with the police and everything. This is something I'd buried at the age of 9. And I never told anyone till I was 43 about what had happened to me at school. And it was like oh my God, it's opened up everything. I can understand why
was a monkey off your back then, and
why I was like this at school.
Yeah.
Why you know, why I was so anti-teachers, you know, something bad happened to me at school with a teacher. And how many more kids have got this going on? How many more kids are just bury stuff, just bury it, and it could go to school, or they go into life and it comes out. It's understanding what has happened to you, being frank and honest and talking about it. And once it comes out, once you can talk freely about it, it's been my life-saving moment for me. When I said to my therapist what happened, and I never told my parents, never told anyone about what happened to me. And it was such an astonishing thing that I can now, everything, like a jigsaw. My jigsaw's come together, slowly coming together. I'm still working. I've still got a lot of work to do, but it's coming together. You know, now I can reflect when things are going to happen. I can stop them happening. I can preempt my behaviour. You know, I can stop my anger. You know, now I don't drink. Now I don't take drugs. Also, I was using the drugs, using the alcohol to mask over certain things, which I didn't know. You know, me injury that, you know, that wanted to be accepted by the club, that arm around me, you know, which I didn't get really. Yeah, it's a massive, massive moment for me. And that's why I like working with youngsters I'm not gonna give up working with our kids who are always in trouble. There's a reason for it. Don't just throw them away and say it was a wrong one. There's a reason for that. Do you know what's happened to them? What's happened to these kids at home and at school? And what's happened? Something happening for them. You know, why are they offending age 12? What's happened to them? You know, let's work on them. Let's work on our kids. Don't just throw them into the gutter. They're a wrong one. Because that was me.
It's the future of Brum as well, isn't it? That we're looking, that you're looking out for. It's the future of Birmingham and whatever, the world, isn't it?
The easy thing to do is just to castigate someone for their behaviour and give up on them. It's easy, isn't it? Well, just get rid of them. Let them go. But let's work with them. They're our future. Kids are our future.
That's close.
Yeah.
So finally, what kind of advice could you give to someone who's watching this who's like, okay, I'm ready for it. I'm ready to tackle demons or addictions, or I know you said that people need to realise. How can you advise someone to get there faster, to realise faster, or is it just sometimes down to the person? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard for not any bit of advice, because it's not about advice. It's that person will know when they are 100% ready. I can't say to them, oh, go and do this, go and do that. They might not want that. They might not want to go into therapy. They might not want to talk about their past life experiences, which has shaped them unknowingly. They've probably buried loads of things that have happened to them. They don't want to talk about it, but they have to for them to move forward. You have.
So if someone's watching this now and they go, actually, you know what, that if this resonates with someone, what do they do? Where do they go?
Therapy worked for me, but it costs money. To see a therapist on the NHS, there's like a 12-month waiting list, isn't there? You know, we need to invest more into that, into help people. There are people out there, therapists who probably won't have waiting lists, but it's getting the right therapists. You've got to find the right therapists. My wife's a fantastic therapist. I'm quite fortunate that if it wasn't for her, I probably wouldn't be here either, you know, because I'm so fortunate having one on tap that just understands me and my crazy behaviour and crazy mannerisms. I am so, so lucky that I've got a wife who's so good and beautiful and takes me for who I am, and I'm so fortunate. But for people out there, just you've got to hang in there and just understand there's reasons for your behaviour. There's reasons for your addictions. You've got to seek help. But get to me. You've got to find the right therapist. I can put you in touch with the right therapist. I know, you know, my wife's got a fantastic network of therapists. I'm willing to help people. You know, the last thing you want to do is like the Ricky Hattons, who people just can't carry on and 46 years of age and take their own lives. You know, what do we do? It's life. It's not a nice thing, but it's always going to happen.
Mm.
It's always going to happen. There'll be another one in the next couple of months.
So statistically, it's the demographic of men.
Men?
Between 40 and 55 is the highest men. Percentile, isn't it?
Yeah, we are struggling.
Mm.
We're struggling. We're too scared to talk about our feelings.
So talk. That's...
Mm.
It's all right. Yeah, you're talking, but really be open and really try and understand. You've got to dig deep to really want to get better. You've got to really pull your cards on the table. You know, if you really want to get helped, systemic problem, it's families, intergenerational trauma, hand me down. You don't even know it. You know, you'll act like your mum or your dad, you'll do things. They will act like their parents did. And it's just a hand-me-down systemically, you know, and you won't even know about it.
It's catch 22, though, isn't it? Because it's how you become a Blues fan as well.
Yeah, I suppose coming down here every week don't help, does it?
It's a correlation.
It's okay at the moment.
That's why we're Blues fans here, because we are. Yeah. Your dad was, your granddad was. You're not meant to enjoy, just get down there.
It's for all those people, it's okay at the moment. Mm. It's great, it's full houses and everything's happening, everything's going one way. You want to play in the 80s, in the late 80s, you know, and support the club back then when times were hard, when there was 5,000-6,000 down here and football violence was crazy and it was freezing cold and the ground wasn't nice.
And someone pissing at the back of your leg.
Yeah. It was difficult. Yeah. It was really difficult, but, you know, it is what it is.
No, brilliant. Thanks for your time.
No problem, man.
Keep it on.
No problem.
Thanks, mate.
No problem.